coveted. Hey, thank you all for the questions. As you can see, we got some good stuff up on the board. If you want to continue to add, please do. But my hope is that we will park enough time toward the end to be able to talk in a little bit more detail about the following issues. I don't know that I put them up in order, but the greatest number of questions were related to, were related to the Medicaid program and how that works and some of the specifics about eligibility for Medicaid. Coming in close second or pretty tight were questions about long-term care insurance. So we're going to make sure that we touch base on a couple of those things. And some questions about veterans benefits as well. There were multiple folks that were asking the question. There was a question about reverse mortgages. I wasn't surprised about that. Paying for hospice, setting aside money for retirement in terms of future savings for somebody during their work life. An important question that I think is actually linked, there was one question about running out of money for somebody who is in a care facility. And so without, obviously, you know, it'd be inappropriate to do a consult here, but we can use that as a case a little bit about, so how's that work? What's that mean? What happens? It dovetails with the Medicaid discussion. But it also talks about some residents' rights issues that are probably worth our making sure that we emphasize. And then lastly, and the one down at the bottom, but I knew where the heart was of the question, had to do with, we often use the word placement or putting somebody in a facility. At what point, if my heart may even be to do home care, at what point is that not necessarily the appropriate? When do I morally, rightfully use a facility? And I'm gonna try to make sure that we save enough time to touch upon that, because that would actually loop us all the way back to some of those first core principles of biblical theology that we started with, moral theology that we started with in this. Okay, here are my intentions for the next part of our talk, okay? Richard's axiom number 4, we've been following through here. So my next axiom is, kind of principle guiding us, is preparing for the cost of chronic illness is not simply a part of a good financial plan, it is in fact the true test of that plan. We're going to talk a little bit about planning, okay? And what I'd like to do is to, as succinctly as possible, walk you guys through what I use as my steps. Now granted, I might do it in a little bit different kinds of detail than you all will, and generally folks are expecting, you know, that I give them something that looks like it was worth the money that they paid for me to do that. But it's the same set of principles, logically, rationally, how do we work ourselves into making sure that we've covered the abundance of issues that we talked about in that last section through. Okay. The first is about keeping things in balance. This diamond in front of you that is made up of the process of care choices, meaning what types of care do I provide, what do I need, how do I pay for it, and so on and so forth. To come to those care choices, those decisions that must be made, I need to keep some kind of balance between a number of different variables. First and foremost, no surprise to you, would be about faith. I cannot, not just the moral application, but literally at a deep level, I need to make sure that I am staying core central in my relationship with Jesus. This is, if there is any single place in your development process that you will need to steep yourself in prayer, it would be this one. So, because for all the reasons that we talked about before in brokenness, I mean, the good news was that tomb is very much empty. The good news is he's coming back soon, any day now. The good news is I know how the big picture is going to end. The bad news is that I'm still walking around with a pretty broken, messed up heart. And I've got lots of the lingering effects, despite the wonderful rescues that I regularly get from the Holy Spirit in my life. I still deal with all of the fallenness and the brokenness and the tendency toward going back into those selfish and arrogant and foolish ways of the past. So that piece is there. The finances are a practical set of parameters. Yes, I do worship the God who owns the cattle of 1,000 hills, but I also have a God that's pointed out to me that I don't live by bread alone, and that, in fact, I should go ahead and try to figure out how to be a steward with whatever means he has given to me. to be able to make those decisions. So I use those as parameters. The family issues that we talked about before. These are the people that a sovereign God has decided to throw together with me. Okay? You don't get to choose your kin in that regard. You got born into those parents. God is not foolish. He knew what he was doing. And even if that involves trials, and please, don't let me understate that. I've had instances, I had the chance to put some thoughts together in a book chapter many, many, many years ago that involved an extraordinary case of caregiving that was by a woman, a daughter who was reunited to the man who abused her for years. She didn't like him. She didn't want to be around him. She had no interest in having him as a part of her life, other than the fact that she could not shake the fact that when she came before the Lord in front of it, he said, take care of those who are in your family. It's extraordinary. It was the witness of faith I saw in this woman has blown me away to, I'm sitting here now 15 years later, still remembering it as clear as it was yesterday. Her basis for that had nothing to do with affinity. It had nothing to do with feelings at all. It had to do with her deep, prayerful consideration that God is sovereign and that he knew what he was doing and that this must be her job to do. Extraordinary. Function is the term that I use for those issues when we talked about care need. Because again, I don't want to think in terms of diagnosis. Is diagnosis relevant? Absolutely it's relevant. And we talked about it before when I was talking epidemiology. But in the end, it really doesn't so much matter how we got to the point where we can't bathe ourselves, dress ourselves, feed ourselves, take care of our management of our medications or our finances. It really doesn't matter so much how we got to that position, but that we are there and that it needs to be compensated for. So if that lack of function, that dysfunction, came by virtue of something that's progressive, yeah, then it's important that I know this is probably something that's going to get worse. If, on the other hand, it came by something that was quite sudden, like a stroke, well then, boy, life changed awfully fast. That's a different experience than somebody who may have been able to edge into this over months and months and years, okay? But in either case, I need to address that need on the basis of what might be coming up ahead of me and keep these in balance. The diamond needs to stay in the shape of the diamond. If it starts to look in some odd sort of geometry, then you know that something is imbalanced here in terms of keeping this all together. This is the foundational basis for how I go about planning. And yes, this is intentional. I start with the clinical as my foundation. Then I build a legal structure. Then I work with the family before I ever get to issues about money. Why? Well, that's for a couple reasons. One, for those of us both inside of the business but also family members, it's sometimes very easy to put the money down at the bottom of that thing. And now you're really messed up. The first issue is we have a human being here who has care needs. They are a real human being. They have real care needs. We start with those clinical pieces first. We then make sure that we know what is the foundational structure from which this family and this planning can go. Who has the authority to speak if this person isn't going to speak or can't speak for themselves? So the certain element of the legal structure must be in place. And as you'll see in a second, that has far more to do with a person than it has to do with a person's stuff. But the legal structure needs to be in place. Then we get to family, then we get to the money. So let's start clinical. The first steps of building a plan for the care honestly really amounts to replacing anxiety with some information. So instead of this being a diffuse sort of situation, we go out and we get the resources that we need to understand what's going on. The first of those have directly to do with the older adult who has the care need. Discussing, well, I think this is a progressive dementia, is not the same as saying I've actually gone ahead with the diagnostic tests to try to rule out everything else that it might have been but a progressive dementia. To presume that this is something that it is not, because that's what it looks like, and start your planning about money or law around that is foolish, to my mind. It is more important than we start. We are blessed in this particular area of Northeast Ohio to have an abundance of skilled folks. Sometimes they are located within geriatric assessment units, interdisciplinary units, usually affiliated with one of the hospitals or one of the teaching hospitals. Not necessarily. You can put the thing together as well by putting the pieces together. But to be clear, just because a physician sees lots of older adults doesn't mean they actually know anything at all about the care of older adults. So it's very, very important that we have some sense of criterion of either board certification or affiliation, something that indicates to you that this person, that particularly is true when you start getting into subspecialties, the neurologist, the psychiatrist, so on and so forth. It's very, very important that you're dealing with someone for whom geriatrics isn't just their normative because they happen to be in a part of the city where there's lots of old folks, but rather because they actually have taken on the efforts to develop that expertise. Often geriatric assessment is, by definition, interdisciplinary. Not just multidisciplinary, meaning I want the input of a nurse because they understand things about the mundane aspects and the practical applications of healthcare. I want a social worker involved, potentially. We're talking interdisciplinary. These are people that work amongst each other such that the conclusions they come to have been affected by each other. So that they work in team context, or they work in highly communicative context, so that we're able to do that. I highly recommend that approach. One of the things you want to find out, often the social workers are available to do that, folks like me are able to do that, is to find out, so what are the community services that are available in my area, and are they any good? Is there any available data about the quality of those services in addition? There's a daycare right up the street from me. Does anybody know anything about it? There are nursing homes all over the place. This particular person is coming from this assisted living facility, and she seems very nice. Can I find any information about the quality of the services that are provided there? What is known? And the short answer is yes, there are increasingly public databases that we can go to try to at least get some semblance and comparison of some of these quality and cost of the different options, particularly the residential options. Because now you're talking about a higher level of trust in terms of not just somebody coming into the house, as if that's not personal enough, but also you actually bringing an older adult someplace else. And then lastly, the eligibility for public benefits. So first thing we go to first is the clinical. We find out before we start talking about how to organize the money, before we start running in and changing legal documents, the first thing is let's make sure we know actually what we're talking about and that we understand that we're at least in a stable situation. What might that mean? If I'm still in a position where there's multiple physicians, when I ask somebody, so who's the doc? And they can't give me one name. Because it's as likely that the cardiologist is working in neurological areas as the neurologist is working in primary care. It's all messed up. At that point, I tell them, no, we got to do a little consolidating here. Because we need one central repository where we know any drugs that might interact with other drugs. So I've got somebody potentially, for instance, that's showing progressive memory problems, okay? It could be worse than it actually needs to be because they may have drugs on board that are making it worse than it needs to be. There could be excess disability. The goal is let's take a couple of good shots at shaving off all of the excess disability so that whatever we're stuck with, we're stuck with. But at least we're in as strong a position as we possibly can clinically. And then we're looking at services that would make sense for that person. Not the over-impaired person, but the one that actually is likely as optimal as we're going to be able to get medically, clinically. Then we move to the legal realm. And the reason I do this intentionally before we start with the money, because they're going to be connected, no doubt, right? I mean, who's going to be making decisions about the money, how the money's going to be stored, things like that. But the first and the foremost legal consideration involved in this is establishing very, very clear proxy powers. Who's in charge and under what circumstances? Okay? In general, there are two primary instruments that needed, and they have a couple of offshoots that are connected to them. The two primary instruments that are needed are a durable power of attorney for healthcare and a durable power of attorney that is a general, broader general financial power of attorney. Those two instruments. Now, oftentimes that durable power of attorney for healthcare will have a couple of other documents that may be attached to it. They're worth consideration. One of them would be, sometimes that includes an authority to get medical information, what they call a release from the HIPAA regulations, from the health privacy regulations. But if you may wish to have other people in a position to be able to hear that, even if they're not ultimately decision makers. So think about who within this family, or sometimes outside of the family, who is going to be the proxy decision maker? And frankly, my wife and I need that for each other, right? I mean, I have no assurance that I'll be disabled this afternoon, incapable. I need to have not only a clear document. Now, she, as my wife, has the greatest likelihood of being able to walk in and by common law being treated fine in that regard. So do the math on that, folks. If you have a proxy who you believe is the appropriate proxy, and they're not likely to be the first person that would pop up. They may not be the oldest child, the loudest child, the child who's in the member of the medical community. You with me? They're not the one that's going to get heard the most. You want that person to be empowered to be able to come in. Now, good news is durable powers of attorney for healthcare have been exceedingly standardized. They're really, really well done. All around the country, particularly for those of us here in Ohio, we have a standard form, okay? Now, some people will look at that, some lawyers will look at that and say, oh, well, you know, I don't usually use boilerplate. Oh, please, come on, you're walking into an emergency room, you want boilerplate. You want them to know exactly what paragraph of what page they're supposed to look at to know exactly what piece of information they need. And ultimately, there are a couple of deep value moral questions that are to be asked even in a durable power of attorney for healthcare, as simple as that instrument might be. The foremost of those, what we sometimes refer to as the Bishop Pilla Clause, is the section that says, will you give this proxy authority to terminate food and fluids under the following conditions? That you're unconscious, that you're not expected to recover, and so on and so forth, okay? So there's a couple of heavy decisions in there about powers that you're giving or you're withholding from that particular person for a healthcare power of attorney. There's absolutely no statutory reason, structural reason, even logical reason that you would have to have the same person serve as the proxy for the healthcare as for the financial powers. But be aware that whatever you might gain from having two heads better than one, whatever you might gain in terms of the potential for a check and balance in the decision making when it comes to using the money for healthcare, do also remember you might also slow down the process a little bit in that regard. It could also be a Mexican standoff. In other words, this is the quality of care I want. I love that facility. They're going to take great care of mom. They cost $1,000 a month more. And my sibling is saying, I'm not going to cut the money to do that. So be aware that each of those are separate, standalone documents. But those powers are important. HIPAA release is the other piece that goes with the generally with the power of attorney. But you might want to consider others. The last is a document that some of you have this. That is called a living will. Okay, a living will is the most. It's actually a much broader term, but it can mean many different things. But it is an advanced directive of what I want to happen in terms of the end of life, particularly what technologies or services I wish not to have happen. I have some hesitation about the use of living wills. I commend you to talk to other attorneys about it. I do all the time and seek their counsel about it. At a practical level where I live, my hesitation is a really good proxy is just that, a really good proxy. Meaning they don't just have their name on a document that was done once. They have a relationship with the person who is going to receive the care. So if someone has asked you to serve as their durable power of attorney for healthcare or general, that has obliged you, I believe, morally, to a relationship of understanding deeper and deeper and deeper their values. So that should you need to affect that role, you will be able to stand in as them and support their values. That's an important distinction. That's not something that gets tucked away and we never talk about it again. Whew, boy, that was an uncomfortable conversation. I'm glad we got that one over. No, no, no. Every time you hear about Mrs. Jones up the street who had her stroke and is now in the nursing home, that's your window of opportunity to talk. So, Mom, what would you want me to do under those circumstances? Mom, how would you want me to handle this? Okay? You've given me this authority. Now fill me. Fill me with the information and the guidance and the values to be able to use it effectively. Okay? You with me? Same sort of situation. If Mom gave you detailed information and she's pouring out to you as a proxy and you're talking this through and you get it, you kind of know and you're feeling, yeah, it would be an awful situation, it would be a horrible situation, but you're feeling like, I think I kind of know where she's coming from. But she signed a document that supersedes your authority. She may have signed it, a living will, an advanced directive in a living will document, has higher authority. It outranks the proxy. That is an important consideration. At least in Ohio, it does. And so that's a very, very important consideration that I may have at age 55 signed a document based on my values at age 55. I'll use the example that was often used by Professor Rebecca Draper, who used to be at the Case Law School and I thought was illustrative in this. She did work with us in dementia when I was at the Alzheimer's Center. And Professor Draper described it as, wait a second, you're telling me that, and she pictured this guy, this, you know, businessman at the height of his career could not imagine what life would be like being demented. How pitiful. The loss of power, the loss of control. I'd rather be dead. I'd so rather be dead. So he signs off on this. Okay. That same person now is that charming 85-year-old gentleman who, frankly, doesn't know who I am when I come to him, has no idea that he ever signed that, isn't actually very sure what he did for a living, but he knew it was kind of made him feel good to think about it. Okay. Right now, his highest priorities are the nights that they have coffee ice cream instead of chocolate. And honestly, he thinks the nursing assistants kind of smell good and they're kind of cute, and so you got to be careful when you're around him. That's this guy. That's his values. Does he have anything at all in common, according to Professor Draper? We have to ask ourselves, what relationship does he have to the same guy who shared the same body back 20 years before when he signed this advance directive? Does he no longer want to be here? There's nothing about his behavior that indicates to me that he didn't want to be here. He seems to actually feel pretty good, as long as you can get him that coffee ice cream, and as long as you can, you know, be nice to him, particularly if you're a pretty young lady. He's a happy guy. So is the binding document from before? What do I do if all of a sudden he's having a tougher time with something? Should I? So that's the place where it gets a little tricky right now, because in many cases, those documents were written in order to make sure that I couldn't allow another human being to make decisions for me based on their judgment. I wanted power over that. My concern would be, well, why did you have that person as your proxy? And is there anybody else in this world you actually have a relationship with that you would trust, that you would want to empower with that? If at all possible, please, let's let that happen. I appreciate the fact that there are folks in this world who don't have that, and they need to use the documents to guide it. I'm encouraging you all to build the relationships to guide it. Yes.
Point of clarification. When you say proxy, is that the same thing as the medical power of authority?
Yeah, either. A proxy is a stand-in. Great question.
Okay, but now, I want to go back and make sure. The living will supersedes the proxy.
That is correct. Yes. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of folks don't know that. It is, yes, I do believe it varies by state, but don't quote me on that. I know Ohio quite well in that regard. Mickey. The question is whether once it's been signed, whether it can be negated. Absolutely, yes. Yeah. The challenge with all powers of attorney documents, just in case you wanted to know this, is it's a little bit like I think the first time that somebody was trying to explain to me about speaking falsely against my neighbor and the power of that particular sin, like standing at the top of a mountaintop and opening up the pillowcase, letting the feathers fly, and then trying to collect them back up afterward. You know, that lie, that gossip spread and spread and spread and spread. Okay, we'll follow the same thing. Whoever has been a recipient of a copy of that durable power of attorney presumes that that is powerful. So we do have a challenge, practical challenge, that if I have a situation where a person has changed their, in most cases, the financial powers are the big one on this. Changing the powers, it's not like I send it to the county recorder's office and now it becomes a place that everybody goes up and pulls it up to make sure that it's real. If the banker had the previous durable power of attorney and that person shows up at the teller window, they're probably going to get the money. So there is a practical problem that goes with this. You can go ahead and change the document as often as you want to. Unlike a will, okay, where, you know, with the will, there may be a bunch of them floating around. That's part of the reason that we go ahead and file the will. The power of attorney is a more organic kind of document. The downside about it is that whoever has it, whatever copy they have, they presume is binding. And if someone wants to affect that, they can. You with me on it? So in many cases, if you change a durable power of attorney, durable general power of attorney for financial functioning, for instance, you got to get back out to the bank. You got to get back to the financial advisors. You got to let them know that person's no longer who was in charge of my finances. Otherwise, the other person potentially could be. And yes, you can imagine some of the exploitation cases I've been pulled into, that in fact was the dynamic. Yes, question?
Okay, just
Venera.
A comment more
yes.
than anything else. Powers, you're yeah. absolutely right. Powers of attorney, now there have been so many things that people have taken advantage of that it would be good when you are setting up a power of attorney, general power of attorney, to make sure to check with your financial institution, with your advisor, to make sure that that particular institution is taking it the way that it's meant to be.
Exactly. The point, just for the recording, is that in many cases, some financial institutions will ask you to sign their own paperwork that names a representative, a legal representative on that particular account. So it can get convoluted. But some of that is the fact that what I just very described to you, there might be multiple copies of the power of attorney floating around. There's no central repository that they would know. So that what they know is the one that they had signed in their office with their representative. And they're feeling more comfortable about that. But that many more documents floating around.
So what about getting back to Nick's question about, if I think I understood him correctly, how about if you had a living will, how do you undo a living will?
Okay. The advantage of a, by definition, the powers of attorney document are only real to the degree that someone receives them on the other end and has someone asserting that proxy authority. Okay? So in the case of, to use, sort of Venera's illustration, if this is an ongoing relationship, like a bank or your financial advisor or something like that, and there's a proxy affecting those, then they have a copy of something. Okay? The durable power of attorney for healthcare, for instance, is likely not to be a sustaining. Now it might be. You might have taken one over to the doctor's office and bring a laminated copy and say, that's it, right there. That's the one that we're using. It's possible. Certainly, I often recommend make sure that the power of attorney and any other kinds of information is available to emergency medical technicians in the two likely places that emergency medical technicians would show up when they pop into the house. What do you think those are? Number one? Refrigerator. Number two? Medicine cabinet, yes. The refrigerator and medicine cabinet would be the two places that if an EMT or a paramedic shows up, they're going to be checking to try to figure out what's going on in here if they have an unconscious or delirious person that they're dealing with. And you want them to know who to call and who is given the authority to be able to take over from here and make decisions. Okay? The living will, by definition, does not become a real document until we have an end-of-life situation for which it would be used. So unless a person is currently in terminal care and we're under the powers of that living will and affecting that, there'd be no reason why simply destroying that document wouldn't be adequate. You could, and I sometimes recommend, some lawyers recommend, going ahead and in anything, much like you would with a will, having a formal document attached to the rest of your documents that says, I rescinded it on the following date. But for all practical purposes, unless you're already in affecting some of the choices that come with terminal care, your living will becomes irrelevant. If it is floating around, then it's important that you remove all copies from circulation. Okay, principles that go along with this on the legal piece, obviously prioritize life over estate. I often talk with folks who not only just have a will, which is a good thing to have, okay, but they actually have a living trust that they put a lot of effort into and so on and so forth, but they've not named proxies at all. So the much higher likelihood of dealing with disability, death, they're good. They know who's going to get their stuff after they're dead, and they like it. They feel good about that. But they haven't dealt with any of the issues that would have to do with life and disability and the inability to be able to make decisions. So prioritize the issues that we might have to deal with in life and health and disability over issues of estate. When you're dealing with issues of estate, I want you to encourage you to consider legacy over stuff. Okay? So in other words, the key discussions about passing things on after I'm gone are values discussions. Those are about how I want things to go. In some cases, I see family members occasionally, and rightfully so, some of this stuff gets pretty complicated. So they're running around trying to, number one, keep as many things out of probate as they possibly can so that nobody else can make decisions other than the ones that we've made. I get all of that. That's all good, okay? But they never bothered to actually sit down with the older adult and talk about some of the little personal items that really mean a lot to them. Who do you want to have that collection of whatever? And those are meaningful. Now, part of the reason for that is it brings about very positive opportunities for the discussion of that this life is going to end. It's a good, healthy way to talk about, in a generative fashion, the fact that you're not going to be here forever. So keep those kinds of conversations going, particularly if you've been the person that's been appointed the proxy. You want to get that kind of conversation started, okay? Now, that having been said, some of this stuff is complicated. At a very, you know, without going into a lot of estate planning here, the vast majority of folks that I've met at these workshops, year after year after year, have very few assets that ever needed to go to a will at all. They had retirement accounts with named beneficiaries. They had insurance policies with named beneficiaries. They had a house that you could put a transfer on death on the title. They had a car that you could put a transfer on death on the title. They had bank accounts that you could put a transfer on death on the title. They had very, very little that actually ended up being involved in the will. But in many cases, the older adult believed that the will was the key instrument. What really mattered was the will. When in fact, when we went back later and we whiteboarded out and you start to realize, were you aware that your now deceased husband is still named as the only beneficiary in all of these assets? We never did anything about all of that, okay? Or you only had 3 children at the time you did those life insurance policies. You have 4 now. You really banking on the other 3 to cut a share in to make sure that the last kid gets taken care of? So these areas that had to do with titling and beneficiary designations outside of the will were unattended. So in this order, we start this work, but ultimately we do get to the point where we stop and say, let's get those things in good order. We get those things partly so that we don't have to think about them again, and we can make sure. And then lastly, a discussion of end of life naturally connects to the discussion of being a proxy. Okay, family. I alluded to some of the family a second ago. Okay, we start with the parents' values. And in some cases, brothers and sisters in Christ, that means we may be dealing with someone who in some cases may not be have the same maturity in Christ as necessarily you do at this point. And it's important that we work along with them to try to both support their values and their goals, but also recognize the fact that if there's a higher and a better way that you wouldn't withhold from a friend, why would you withhold it from a parent? So in other words, there's a way of saying, I think your decision is foolish, without throwing in their face, I think you're a fool. But to simply say, there's nothing I can do, that's honoring my parent. Well, actually, no, that's not honoring their parent. Go do a word study on that word, and you realize that's actually a level of disrespect. You need to say, I want what's highest and best for you. Can you necessarily get there? No. Anybody raised kids? You know, you do what you can to bring the wisdom to bear on the situation, and then you trust that the Holy Spirit needs to pick it up the rest of the way and take it home, okay? So, but identifying those parents' values, and that may include a capricious parent who wants to keep switching that will all the time because they get ticked off at the one daughter. And you have to try to bring wisdom into that situation as much as you possibly can. The key then becomes, among siblings particularly, siblings or a parent and adult children, assigning appropriate roles and assigning reasonable roles. You know, historically, many of our, if you think just sort of the cohort group, the generations that are involved in many of the, you know, as a middle-aged man, the generation of my parents, in many cases, there were very normative standards. It was presumed that a lot of times the guys would end up managing the money. The women would end up managing the care decisions. There were a lot of sort of very stereotyped decisions about who was best. The key here is that we find appropriate roles and we find reasonable roles. I worked with a great social worker years ago at University Hospitals in Cleveland, and I remember her when we would do part of my job was to meet with the families right after we had given a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And the older adult was right there at the table with us, and we were kind of talking through, and then we'd pick up and do a series of meetings with the families. And I remember the metaphor that she used to use is, okay, this is a family crisis. This is a big deal. This life is now irreversibly changed for this family. So everybody reach into their pockets, pull out, metaphorically, pull out what you got. Your time, your money, your effort, your knowledge. Get it out on the table here because we need it. Okay, now wait a second. Stop. Really? Can you really afford to have that on the table right now? You got kids to raise. You know, you got financial problems of your own. This needs to be reasonable. I don't want it on this table if I can't count on it. I don't want it on this table if I can't bank on it, if it's not going to be there. If in your moment of emotional desire, or for that matter, of the influence of your siblings, you decide to toss forward things that are not reasonable for you to have in this care system, then you better pull that thing back a little bit and make sure. And nobody here, at least at this table, is going to look twice at you for making an honest appraisal that at this moment in life, you've got other things that you need to do. We'll figure it out. We'll reach out. What I don't want is false promises as we move forward on it. The last piece is to address the fact that by definition, you have different human beings that make up the family, so you have different interests of those human beings, and it's highly likely that there's going to be some conflicts somewhere along the way. Thankfully, in my practice, I've only had a handful of instances where I've had to both refuse cases because I was not clear that the older adult's needs and values were going to be respected highly enough, and in one or two cases, actually go to Adult Protective Services to seek out their efforts to assist, because it was very clear to me this was an exploitation in the making. Instances where when I talked to an older adult about, do you know what it would mean if you were making these kinds of large gifts to your family in terms of the use of Medicaid services and things like that? And they're absolutely clueless. Never had this discussion. And I start to discover that in many cases, it's not even kin, it's an in-law that's kind of driving this. And everybody's presuming, well, usually he, sorry to be stereotypic, knows all about the money stuff. And he got good counsel from a lawyer. And then I ask to see, can I see the engagement with the lawyer? And I discover mom's not the client. The family member is the client of the attorney. So we need to just, come on, have our eyes wide open, recognize the fact. In the same way that we talked in the beginning, and I said, isn't this great? I saw some of your eyes. And it's like, yeah, I know about being a follower of Jesus. I know about that hope of the resurrection. I know about the power in the ascension. I know about the imminent return of Jesus. I'm with you, Richard, on all of this. Okay, well then get back to me to the core principle that was before that. I am a pitiful, fallen sinner with a heart that deserved damnation. That's not what I got. I am shedding it bit by the efforts of the Holy Spirit. But if ever I get to the point where I think that I'm either smart enough, good enough, or godly enough that I can somehow trust my own judgment and that my gut sense is going to be a good gut sense, that arrogance is going to take me right into sin and I'm going to hurt somebody. And in this case, it could be a vulnerable older adult that's going to take me there. So we're very mindful of conflicts of interest. I personally believe strongly that in an orchestrated way, we go to a thing called a family meeting. Excuse me. Ultimately, we work with the older adult and their proxy, either that chosen adult, that family member or spouse or whatever, and then we bring in the family members to make sure that there's clear communication. I like that certainly about decisions of life, but also about decisions of legacy. Let's talk about what's going to happen after I'm gone and make sure that everybody's on the same page while we're in life and we can get voices out and make sure that that's clear. Family meetings can be very powerful things. I'll give you my quick example on it. Was at one family meeting, and I was describing how for this particular family, this particular Medicaid rule seemed to apply to them. And the rule went as follows. If you, as a caregiving child, move in with your parent and live with them for a two-year or longer period, during a period of time that, frankly, they could not have lived on their own, they had a medical attestation that they couldn't have lived independently, they would have been in a care facility. Medicaid waives the rules about the house. The house is no longer considered to be an available asset. So if mom then needs to go into a care facility after that point, She can give the house to that caregiving child who was with her for the 2 years prior to that. Well, that's pretty powerful. Up to $500,000+ worth of the house that you're allowed to do that. Pretty big deal, right? Pretty cool rule. Most people don't know about that rule. It's kind of not widely. It's this homestead kind of rule built within Medicaid. And I thought it applied to this particular family, okay? And they were discussing it because there was a good bit of kind of care going on. Well, what I didn't realize within this particular family was there was sort of the one less successful ne'er-do-well sister at the table, okay? And she, you don't understand, when I start these family meetings, I've already met with parents first. And we've talked through what is a possible option and what's not a possible option. Living with that daughter was not necessarily a possible option that was brought to the table on it. I also learned over the years to make sure that my client or clients were on either side of me at the table. And I proposed to them before the rest of the family, we kept them out in the waiting room to kind of just let them stew a little bit, okay? You know, make sure we got the power very clear, okay? So I'm with the older folks in the room. We invite them back in. And I made it clear to the older folks before the rest of the family came in that my foot is going to be underneath in front of your chair. It's going to be right there. Treat it like a brake pedal. If this conversation is going someplace that you're not particularly happy about, go ahead and use my foot. Give me a tap. Let me know. I'll try to redirect it. If I can't do it, give me a couple more taps, and I'll be sure that, you know, we'll do a little sidebar, and we'll figure this out. And it's a little technique. Sorry, I'm giving away my techniques here. If ever I got the chance to work with your family, now you'd know, okay? Watch for his feet, because feet splayed out underneath the table underneath, okay? All right, so up comes this idea. The daughter comes in. Mom, we'd have such fun together. It would be so good. I would love to live with you. I thought the old lady was going to break my foot. The family meeting is still driven by not just the needs, but the values, and if at all possible, the influence of the older adult in the midst of it. But the family meeting is needed. Now, caregivers, some of you in this room are like this. I've watched you looking over at your phone to make sure that you are hearing from whoever's providing respite for you. Okay, caregivers. Everybody's been on an airplane recently, right? You don't even have to be recently. You know the shtick. Some of us don't even hear it any longer that we fly often enough. But there is that point where the new flyer, you hear that little gasp that comes whenever they get to the line that says, in the unlikely event of a sudden loss of cabin pressure, this little mask will drop out from the top. And what do they say next to do? Exactly. Put your mask on first before attending to the person next to you. Caregivers, this is not selfishness. It's wisdom. Okay? If you're watching your life, your physical life, your own health, your own finances, your own marriage, your own parenting, other caregiving obligations you have, if you're watching them fall apart with the sense of, I can hang on, this is what I need to do for mom, that is a very, very foolish and risky thing to do to mom, much less to you. There's no value to it. It's a situation I have when I have a, you know, tiny little female caregiver with a large man who maybe post-stroke can only put weight on the one foot. And I'm thinking, oh, great. How many broken hips will I have at one time? You know, will we get a discount for bringing them both in at the same time? Because she can't manage this in this situation. And it's unrealistic to think that she can. They're both at risk now. He's a greater risk because of her efforts to try to do something. So, in the unlikely event of a sudden loss of cabin pressure. So the key to my mind, the first thing is attend to your own health. Make sure you need to do what you need to do to stay in there. This is a marathon in most cases. This is not a sprint. Buy time. That's what respite is for. Those services that we talked about earlier are in part to make sure that you're using it for whatever is that highest and best use. If that is running your errands, because those are the things that really you needed to get done and they refresh you. But if they're not, if they're for you to get to the gym, if they're for you to take a nap, whatever it is, you make your determination on what you need to buy time for. Do not neglect your own financial planning, legal planning, documents, and your work with your spouse in exchange. Now we're just compounding the problems to the next generation, potentially. And lastly, do not take lightly Paul's admonition to the church at Philippi, because they were equally in a mess. They're out in the hinterlands. They got Roman troops floating all over the place, okay? They didn't even know what their identity is going to be as the body of Christ there. And he says to them, be anxious for nothing. But in everything, here's the part that's so tricky. With thanksgiving, counting your blessings, offer your requests to God. And then here's the part that gets kind of interesting. And a peace that goes beyond all understanding will guard your heart and your mind in Christ Jesus. The prayer is not the afterthought. The prayer is actually the weapon of this particular value, of this particular battle, and needs to continue on. The money. Okay. In a summary nutshell, what are we trying to do as financial foundations within the planning? Well, what we're trying to end up with is a very simple structure with specific strategies that have to do with elder care obtained from sound counsel. That's what we're looking for. Elegance is not a goal in this case. It may be an inevitability because of the complexity of the situation. Don't get me wrong. But having an elegant estate plan, for instance, and having something that honestly nobody in the family actually knows how to run, nobody knows what it means. I don't know it's in the trust there somewhere. I know it must have been attended to. Foolish. Terribly foolish. Somebody else is going to have to be exacting this. So it needs to be simple enough that somebody would be able to explain back, this is what we do with the money. This is how we pay our bills. This is how we store our investments. This is who it's going to go to upon death. Simple, simple, simple in terms of its structure. What does that mean? Well, the first element of that is, sorry, everybody, we all live by budgets. A budget is simply that if you're recognizing the fact that this is God's money, not your money, you need to be able to, like any of us in financial accounting, you need to be able to report to the owner what you're doing with his money. And in that regard, so to have some clear understanding of this is what I can afford, this is what I'm spending on, and to have that clear and preferably to have that documented would be a really good idea. Banking relationships. Banking relationships go the whole breadth, right? I mean, you've got folks with private wealth managers who really are buying investments at the level of their bank, okay? And you have other folks who are getting Medicaid planning advice from tellers. And it's everything in between. So we live in a highly diverse, multidimensional financial services industry. So people get their financial advice and their financial products in lots of different ways. Banks have over the years, particularly for the generation of the great generation, banks were a central hub for that. So they may not even know. For instance, longtime investor in certificates of deposit. That's fine. I like CDs. I didn't need that money for that period of time. I didn't need it to be liquid to me. So I used to laugh when I first got started in the business. I would ask some of my older clients, so what are the CD rates? Because they knew. It was the inside, you know, Cleveland Plain dealer, inside metro section to the left, down at the bottom, and all the banks had listed what their interest rates were. Okay, well, there's no interest out there right now, guys. So they come into the bank, and a banker, they think as a banker, tells them, I can get you 2.5%, 3% on something. They don't stop and go, wow, I wonder why nobody else can get me that. Sure, that's good. They've signed up now for a multi-year annuity that they may have to take a significant surrender charge to be able to get the money out, when in fact we needed to get that money out for their care. But it seemed reasonable because now I'm finally getting some halfway decent interest. What they actually did in those documents that they signed, they went into a relatively significant and relatively complicated, in some case, financial transaction. But they did it at the same place that they got CDs all those years, and they get a checking account, and it didn't seem so. So structure simple, a specific strategy, and in particular, if we're talking about the possibility of needing to use public benefits, you know, in the world of finance, there's basically three things we can manipulate, and you only get two out of the three. I can get you yield, alpha. I can get you protection from risk, beta. And I can get you liquidity, the ability to be able to hold on to the money. I can't give you all three at the same time. So if you want a higher yield, I either need to expose more of your money to risk to get that yield, or I need to hold it from you and let somebody else have it for a while so that they can invest it. And so on and so forth. I can get you super safe money if you want me to, but I probably can't get you the highest yield by doing it unless I also give away some of the liquidity. I can manipulate one of those three and come up with lots of different possible combinations. Can't give you all the three. Any human being out there that tells you they can give you all the three, They're lying. It doesn't work that way. It's just not finance, okay, to be able to do that. So if I think I might need additional liquidity in order to make myself eligible for public benefits, then it's very important that I built that into the structure, right? If I might be over the next X number of years, I'll give the best example. If in the next 5 years of my life, I might need Medicaid to pay my bills, I can't give away money. And to be honest, depending upon the county, I can't give away money to a pledge campaign for something at my church, which might be my heart's desire. I believe in that. I want to do that. But the realistic attitude is if I walk in after this crisis, I don't know how sick I'm going to get in the next 5 years, particularly if I'm 80 at the time that we're talking about the next 5 years, then I'm walking in and I just gave this money and a caseworker is going to ask, well, what happened to this? 4 years ago, your bank accounts were at this level. What'd you do with that other money? Oh, I gave it to my grandson to use for college. That's a lovely idea, but I'm not going to approve that on the basis of that. And wouldn't have to necessarily. I mean, it's a tricky situation right now because what we're talking about, remember before I said older adults in part are gaining their sense of how to be good older adults and not be stingy and focused on self and you know, spending your time thinking about woe is me and my bowel movements that I haven't had recently. You don't want an old person like that, right? You want a person who's giving and releasing and letting it go. That generativity is a part of how they get to the point of that ego integrity we talked about before, but the rules don't allow that kind of generativity necessarily. And so we need to be very careful, and that's where we get to the sound counsel. We need to work with folks that have actually done this stuff before. Attorneys that didn't decide because there's a market in it, and I think I'll go into elder law, and I know how to do these transactions. And incidentally, I'm charging you a fee high enough that the insurance I bought for your potential malpractice suit, I'll be good. I'll be covered. And that's the reason that my fee has jumped up so much, because I see what the liabilities are. You know, maybe I don't really want to engage in that kind of a potential dynamic. This is right now a very, very tricky time in the world of financial services, over issues of who's entitled to do what and under what obligations and duties to you they are functioning, okay? In general, I'm going to strongly encourage you, if this is somebody you're going to be working with, getting counsel for mom or dad, it is important that you understand, are they in fact acting, remember, they're a professional. What does that mean? That's not something I just clamp on. Professional means I know information you don't know, and you won't possibly know it. So there's always a space between us. There's always an ethical space between you and me that I know something you don't know. You can fill that in with trust if you want to. You also need to verify some of that to make sure I am who I said I am. You need to try to make the least amount of that gap, but that gap will always be there. Think about it. You go to your physician, I'll use as a penultimate example of a professional. You go to your physician. Not only is that person entitled to take out a prescription pad and put chemicals potentially into your body that could hurt you or help you, have all that power, they also get to decide what was the reason we were putting those chemicals for in the first place. You didn't know you had that thing when you walked in. Based on that person's word, I guess I have that, so I guess I better take that. And they get paid for it. There's always that gap in any professional relationship. And we need to be clear about that. So how does one fill in that gap? One fills in that gap in many cases by what they can attest to. Increasingly, the standard that we're looking for is referred to as a fiduciary. Somebody who has already openly acknowledged, I must act in your best interest, not in mine. Now that may surprise you that there's a lot of folks, of the millions of folks that can work in financial services and sell you something that don't have that standard. Their standard is suitable. This is good for you. That doesn't necessarily mean it's best for you. It means it's good for you. It's okay. It fits you. It might actually be of all the possible things that are good for you and suitable for you, this is the one that pays me the most. So it's very, very important that we scrutinize that, okay? Particularly those potential conflicts of interest that have to do with free help. Okay, come on, right? What do we teach our kids? Ain't nothing for free, right? I mean, we kind of knew that, right? So all the free stuff that, you know, I've had to deal with my young people of, you know, when you get something on the internet for free, when they give you something on your phone and you didn't have to pay anything for that, you do realize you gave up something for that. That might be privacy and you don't care about that, but it's something. There's always a transaction that involves in this, right? Otherwise, who got paid to do it in the first place? So on and so forth. Right now, we are at a very flourishing time for web-based advice that appears to be unconflicted, free advice. This is the right thing to do. And then you find out that the sponsors and the advertisers for that particular source of advice actually have a base. In fact, you might hypertext link on it for more information, go here, and you find out you're no longer at another page of that page that you want, another page of the website that you were on. You're over at a whole nother company that sells something. Increasingly, some of the places for that are, for example, when you're working with the social worker at the hospital and you're doing discharge planning, please be advised, might be a great person, might be a great nurse, social worker, good human beings, okay? But their job, they work for the hospital. Their job is to get you someplace. If they can also get you someplace that works out to be the best place for you to be, cool, that's great. But that's not their obligation. Their obligation is to move out that bed, clear out that bed, and keep things going. That's their business in that regard. They're done getting paid what they're going to get paid for that particular thing. Same deal with assisted living facilities. We increasingly have a large number of referral agents. So these are folks that will say, I won't charge you anything. I'll show you around to different facilities. Some are great, wonderful human beings. I'll get you information. I'll guide you. I'll even literally take you place to place to place so that you can see places that might be appropriate for your loved one. And what you find out later is if they took you to this place, they might make nothing or a couple $100 from their parent organization. If they took you to that place, they might get $3,000 or $3,500 of commission based on the first month's rent there. Now, I don't know about you guys, but that would be a conflict I would want disclosed to me when we came in. Did you mean someone, we're going to see three places today, and two of the three will pay you, but one will not? How could that not sway your thinking in this? It may not. They may be really good, honorable people, but it's the kind of thing you would kind of want disclosed. So that commission could pull some of the thinking, could pull some of the direction, and if it doesn't, God bless them. They're very, very disciplined people in that regard. VA benefits, the same deal. There is, to be clear, an attorney can charge to assist you in an appeal if you get denied veterans benefits. Nobody can get paid to apply for veterans benefits. There are veterans service organizations and a handful of private individuals that have been certified by the VA to do that. Okay? So it's really important that what's that mean? Then why is he giving it to me for free? Well, probably because nothing wrong with that. He or she is building a relationship with you that might be a good relationship. They just gave you something of added value. So when we talk about the other financial stuff, and they're an insurance agent or they're a financial services person, that this was sort of something that they gave in exchange to build that relationship. That's not inherently wrong, but it probably should be disclosed, I think. The role of commissions and the influence of commissions is an important consideration. Getting paid that way is just one other way of getting paid. There's nothing inherently immoral in it. But disclosing it, or the other way around, refusing to disclose, saying this is free, even though actually my time is going to be paid by someone else other than you, would seem to me to be something that would need to be disclosed. That includes that last piece. When we're talking about planning for Medicaid, and we're going to talk about some of the specifics on Medicaid in just a second here, it's technical. It's specific. It has absolutely everything to do with this particular case. Can take a lot of time, can take a lot of thought, can take a lot of training. It's a subspecialty within financial planning. Don't get me wrong. So Medicaid planning, for even somebody who is actually quite indigent, is a perfectly appropriate thing to do. Might be quick. We might go right into the social worker, get applications in, so on and so forth. For some folks, it might be much more complicated than that. But planning Medicaid for care versus planning Medicaid for estate are two very, very different things. There are many attorneys right now who are making their living and they are doing Medicaid planning for estate. The purpose is, the stated goal, is I want to get as much money down to my kids as I possibly can. I don't want to, quote unquote, give it to the government. Now, wherever you are in terms of your notions about distributive justice and the ethics of all of that, that's not what I'm getting into right now. What I'm getting into is know the goal. Know the goal, know the objective, and therein know the client. in this. If the client says, I want to get all my money to my kid, I don't care what happens, somebody should disclose to them what the I don't care might include, because it could be very substantial. It may not be any difference in the quality of care they receive, but it could be that they have significant problems in getting eligibility in the first place. They could find out themselves in a very, very complicated situation by not having done that correctly. The key to me is lots of people need Medicaid planning to get into the program, rightfully, lawfully, appropriately, and with the most optimal value. Medicaid estate planning to take care of the next generation, that's a different issue. Okay, last axiom, and we'll go into some specifics here. Yes, good, 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 good. All right, 15 minutes. Last axiom. Okay, you saw I built the plan, right? We started clinical. We moved from clinical to the legal structure. We go to family after that, and we take care of the money. We built this thing, okay? Sounds like we got it in order. We're doing a good job. We hired good financial counsel, good legal counsel. We did it. We did our work, right? We can trust in it, right? No. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. Nobody who's actually a follower of him is he ever going to put in a position where he's cut you loose on your own. By definition, he said, I'm not leaving you. I'm not forsaking you. We can hug that to us in the hard days. Don't forget it in the other days, too. It means I'm on you. You're mine. You belong to me. So when you make a plan within the sphere of my sovereign providence. My providence is good. My providence is sweet. My providence is also sometimes very hard. I have severe mercies. I know what is good. What God gives me, he's always working it out. All things together for good. I'm called according to his purposes. I know that at this point in my life. I'm his. So how come the circumstances in front of me don't seem very good sometimes? They hurt. He defines good. The only thing I know is stay close to me. Don't leave me. As long as I'm tight to you, as long as I know your Holy Spirit here, I will let you define in hindsight. Those of us, you know, it's interesting because Mickey and I were making jokes. So how long have you been doing this? And I said, I don't know. I feel like I went straight from Kids of the Kingdom into doing this, okay? Some lessons from Kids of the Kingdom are valuable forever. And so when you tell the story of Hinds Feet on High Places, for those of you who don't know that, go get a copy of Hernad's Hinds Feet on High Places. Lovely little, stupid little allegory, but it's deep and it's beautiful. And she had made her way trying to get to the high places where the shepherd was, around and around and around. And each time some sad, hard thing happened to her. The voice of her companions holding her hands, sorrow and suffering. Who ultimately, when the shepherd arrived and they made it to the high places, turned into grace and mercy? I can't remember. They were given new names. But they were sorrow and suffering at that time, and it hurt to hold their hands. And each time there was a milestone of pain and a lesson learned, she had to reach down and pick up this little stone, whatever. There was always a stone right there as they were walking about, and put it in the little bag that the shepherd had told her to take with her on this journey. And she had this stupid bag full of stupid little stones that she'd picked up in all these hard days of one thing after another after another. How many times she wanted to pitch that bag of stones out? I didn't want this job, God. I didn't want to be the caregiver. I love mom, but why me? Where are my brothers? How come they're not a part of this thing? I didn't want this. It's not like my marriage is that strong right now. It's not like my kids are perfectly well behaved. It's not like I got tons of money in the bank. I can ill afford this right now, God. Pick up your bag. Keep walking. Go to the next. Another stone. We get to the high places. She opens the bag of stones. Sorry, I'm taking away the end of the story from you all if you haven't read it. Each of them were the jewels that were then placed into the crown that was laid on her head when she got to meet the shepherd. I have no idea why his ways are his ways. They are higher than mine. And I'd be a fool to give you some kind of platitudes here. I've now spent enough of my life with caregivers doing this work. I come in with respect, and I come in with admiration for many, but I recognize the fact that a sovereign God has his ways of ordering my steps as I go about this. I encourage that we take the planning, but that we recognize a sovereign God who means us well, who favors us in Christ Jesus, will be ordering those steps. Cool? Good?